This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful handcrafted agricultural journal. Purchase a copy today at southernfarmandgarden.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, career changers, chefs. Who else? I don't know. Anybody else, really.
We're
pretty open. Yeah, people who have moved, or in the case of our current guest, not moved, but maintained two simultaneous careers in Nigel's case, in design and in food. So this is our last episode of our summer season, so we're sad that you won't get to listen to our voices for the next few weeks, but we will be back at the beginning of September.
And Ethan is back from Turkey this week.
I'm back from Turkey this week. And Jenny is off the high of an amazing event last night at the Museum of Food and Drink in Woo-hoo. Brooklyn. And we have an awesome guest. So a perfect end to our pretty fun summer, I would say. So anyway, let me introduce Nigel Seeligar. He is the founder of Course, which is a design firm.
Course Design Factory.
Course Design Factory, thank you. And also the cosmonaut and one of the founding pair of...
Moonman
of Hello Moonman, which is an Indonesian coconut and other ingredient cake business, currently at the Queen's Night Market and other markets around the city, and opening a brick and mortar soon. So, Nigel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we always open with our aha question that we tweaked a little bit this season. But can you bring us to the moment where you either knew you wanted to definitely pursue food in your case, or when you were, after you've started in the food industry, when you had this moment of like, oh my gosh, I am doing the right thing. This is what I was meant to do.
Oh.
Take us there.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit different because I'm still a designer, right? So by practice. So Monday to Friday, I'm a designer. Sunday another weekend, I run the food business. I always wanted to have a food business on the side for a long time, you know, partially because I like to eat. And it's one of my mentality in a way that if I like design, I become a designer, you know, and then I'll listen to classical music. I really like it. So I learned how to play violin. And then, I like to eat. So might as well, you know, figure out a way to sell food.
Classic entrepreneur mentality. You're like, I like to do something, so I'm going to devote an outrageous amount of time and effort to it.
Become an expert at it.
And become a total expert and make myself crazy trying to do it.
It's as simple as that. So I've always wanted to do it for a long time.
So how did you feel when you opened at Queen's Night Market for the first time? You got your first guest or your first customer and you're selling your first mooncake.
Well, clearly, on the first night, we have no idea what we're doing.
Yeah.
Wendy and I, you know, we both clueless. We never run in a market setting before. So we only have one stove running, and it wasn't enough. And then the coconut pancake takes forever. Like, people were waiting for over an hour?
Our
coconut pancake. Because, you know, one griddle, there's only, like, you know, seven slots, right? So we can only cook seven at a time. And people were ordering like crazy, so we can't keep up.
So how many did you sell the first night?
Like, around 400, I think.
Oh, and so how many have you been selling since then?
On an average night
On an average night now.
Like around 700-800.
Oh my god.
Wow.
Yeah. That's like average. Yeah. It can go more than that sometimes. Yeah.
And so you, in your design firm, you kind of provide a full service design process for companies. But tell us about the process of doing that for yourself. You are now sort of your own customer.
Yeah.
You're thinking through what the brand should look like and how it should feel and how customers should experience it. Tell us about that debate between your two sides and then having to actually implement the design that you've come up with.
Well, Moonman, I approach it like a design project. I don't approach it like the way restaurateurs, you know, do it. So I think about it from the design standpoint, right? So we know what we need to do for the operational standpoint, how we fix, redesign the product, and then how we present the brand, the language, and promotions, and what kind of engine we're going to need, you know. So we approach it from that standpoint. Yeah, the only difference is that we're the one on the...
It's a big
steering
difference.
Wheel. Yeah. Yeah. We're the one on the steering wheel that have to crank this out, you know, instead of usually we just provide the solution to our client, you know, and then we have vendors to implement it for us. So that's the only difference.
And so what about the brand and the name? Can you tell us where that came from and what has been like the brand approach? What do you want people to feel and think of when they see Hello Moon Man?
Well, originally when I constructed the brand is that I want to avoid the usual approach for ethnic food branding, right? Mm-hmm. So if we can see in the entire Queensland market, most of them has the name that is like ethnically relevant to their heritage, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's why it's being used as a name. But that approach has been used for how many times now, you know, it's overdone. And then I know that I don't want to go that route. And then the opposite of that is actually to do something completely nonsensical, right? So we want to have a name that has nothing to do with Indonesia, have nothing to do with food, in fact, you know. So I after two mojitos in the restaurant,
just two mojitos?
What?
Just
it two was a large mojitos. So after two large mojitos in the restaurant, I had this idea that, okay, why don't we just call it Moon Man, you know, because it sounds funny, it's memorable. And then it's open to interpretation. So let people decide what the Moon Man connection is to the coconut pancake. And well, yeah.
What do people think it is?
What?
What do people think that?
Oh, there is a lot of many guesses. Like they think that, you know, I love astronaut. They think that the coconut pancake actually look like the moon. So there is a lot of theories.
Is it ever challenging because it's not related to food, making sure that people, I mean, obviously at the night market, people know that you're making food, but you know, on social media or on the web where they're not seeing the food in front of them, making sure they understand you sell a food product.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, if we think about it, the name always comes with the context, right? So the coconut pancake is always be there. The description will always be there. So I don't think it's ever been an issue. You know? And I think, you know, part of being in the design firm also, what I kept telling people is that you're stressing way too much over the name because you have to see the entire system, ecosystem of a product or a brand. Like you can't just decide on the name and you know that it's good or bad because it doesn't come with everything else.
Tell us about your product. What, for someone who hasn't tasted, I've been lucky enough to taste it many times at the night market, but what are you serving? What does it taste like? What does it look like? How do customers react to it?
We currently have three products. So we have the Indonesian coconut pancake. So that's originally in Indonesia called, depends where you are. Certain area call it Rangin, and then certain area call it Bandros. The other area call it Kue Pancong, and they're all the same thing. It's just like regional names anyway. And then that's a coconut pancake made of fresh coconut, coconut milk, and rice flour. And then we put a little bit of sugar on top, and then we brulee it.
With a blowtorch.
With the blowtorch, cool. Yeah. And then the second product is a pandan steam cake. So that's made of pandan leaf that we grind, take the juice, mix it with flour and egg, and then we foam it and we steam it. That's how we make the cake, I think.
Can you tell us what pandan is for people that don't know?
Sure. Pandan has been deemed the Southeast Asian vanilla. So it's a really fragrant palm leaf, I think.
That's a good description for it.
Except that Southeast Asia has vanilla. It doesn't. Southeast Asia's vanilla.
How would you know that?
But pandan is more popular.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. And then the last one.
So how would you describe the flavor of pandan?
Pandan is more on the spongy kind, so it's more cakey. While the coconut pancake tastes more like has the texture of a creme brulee. So it has like the crushed sugar and then it's creamy on the inside.
What the flavor of the pandan leaf itself, like it's very aromatic?
Very aromatic. It's very fragrant.
It's kind of sweet and nutty.
Yeah,
almost, right?
Sweet and nutty.
Like toasted hazelnuts or something like that.
And then the last one is a big cassava cake. So big cassava cake in Indonesia is called Kue Singkong. And then in Malaysia it's called Pinka Ubi. And then I think in Philippines it's called Pipinka, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so it's that's our third product. So that's more like a mochi-like consistency. It's very chewy.
And can you tell us what cassava is for people who don't know?
Cassava is
we're making you define so many ingredients.
Cassava is a type of root vegetable, actually. It looks like potato, but it's a lot longer, and then it has, you know, a thing on the middle, and then, yeah.
How does it taste different, or how is the texture different?
Cassava, if you bake it, is actually chewy. Yeah, it makes it chewy. So a lot of the tapioca starch is made of cassava, right? So.
Yeah. And why those three products? How, what was the recipe development process like, or the menu development process?
Oh, Wendy and I did a lot of test kitchen. So we try out a bunch of different recipes and tweaking it, you know, and make them ours.
And tell us your relationship with Wendy, and how did you know that you wanted to work with him?
With her.
Oh, well, with her, I'm sorry.
She's my cousin. Yeah, she's my cousin, and she happened to run a restaurant in New Jersey, a Japanese restaurant with her husband. And we needed a kitchen, so we needed a kitchen, you know, so they got a kitchen. So yeah, it kind of just falls into place.
And when you wanted to start on these couple recipes, what was the first batch like? You know, what, like, how did you adjust it over time to get to where you are now?
Oh, there is a lot of adjustment. You know, the water content is always different. And then the we have so many coconut pancakes that feels like a hockey puck because it was too dense, and yeah, we have many failures.
Whose job was it to make the decision, like, this is the right batch, this we got,
oh,
the
we put
right
the two three on it.
Was that hard? Were there no. cases where you disagreed?
No. So far has been quite
easy.
It was
pretty clear. This one's good. This one's not.
Yeah. So far has been pretty easy. Yeah.
And what were the customer reactions? You said earlier when we were having lunch that a lot of people don't know what coconut pancakes are or some of these other things. Like, how do you educate them properly on that? And then when they are eating it for presumably the first time, like, what do they look like? How are they feeling? What's their reaction like?
Coconut is a tricky thing because some people don't like coconut, right? And then what I realized is that some people who don't like coconut is because of the texture, not really because of the taste.
Hmm.
And usually they're okay with curry with coconut milk, for example, but then they're not okay with grated coconut, right? But because our coconut pancake is cooked in a way that the coconut pieces in there is actually soft, so people just presume it as part of the whole experience, right? So it's they think of it like a creme brulee more than actually a pancake with a grated coconut on the inside.
And the idea came sort of from memories of eating these as a kid in Indonesia, right?
Yes.
Tell us about the process to kind of recreate those memories in food here.
Well, Wendy and I both like this dessert. We used to have it. This used to be like an after school kind of snack, right? They sell it on the street. You know, you got from school and then you just buy it on the street and then you walk home with it. And then what we found out is that A, it's really hard to find it in Indonesia these days because nobody is selling them anymore. Nobody's making them, nobody's eating them, you know.
Why
and then
not?
It's a dying art, right? There's no innovation happening in that arena. So all these coconut pancakes have been in the same way over and over for generations, and then there is no change, there's no innovation, and then the younger people are not interested in it, nobody wanna continue doing it. So, of course, it's slowly disappearing.
Do you find that the younger Indonesian people who might live in the States would have like a more of kind of like this nostalgic desire for this versus
they
the...
They do, actually. What we found is that if we have Indonesian customers coming to our booth, especially from the older generation, they would recognize what it is.
But younger people?
Younger people, not as much. You know. So sometimes they do, but most times they don't.
And
yeah.
Maybe the next step is to go back to Indonesia and try to recreate the success of Moon Man.
I've been asked quite a few times. Like, why don't we open one in Indonesia so that, you know, you can have this coconut pancake there too?
And what do you think? Would you do it?
Well, one step at a time.
So, I mean, do you feel a responsibility or do you feel a burden that goes along with preserving this, like you said, a dying art in this particular food?
I wouldn't think of it as a burden. I would think of it actually as an advantage. Because if you have something that other people don't, that's an asset, right? So that's how I think about it.
If this is a dying art, how were you able to get some of these recipes that you've started with? Obviously, you've tweaked them now. Yeah. But were you sourcing from friends and family? Were you just looking online?
We look everywhere. We look everywhere. And then we know that the base ingredient is going to be rice flour, coconut milk, and grated coconut. You know, just from memory, we know. So, you know, it's just the ratio is what we don't. You know, so
ratios are thing. Yeah.
The ratio is the one that makes up the recipe, right? Not so much the ingredient. So that's the one that we have to test over and over again.
You mentioned over lunch earlier that you've been talking to the Indonesian consulate here about expanding the reach of Indonesian food here in New York and also just kind of in the States, making it more well known. Also making sure that when people think of Indonesia, they don't just think of Bali. Can you talk a little bit about your thought process behind how to bring Indonesian food kind of into more of the spotlight and just have people gain more familiarity with it?
Well, the problem with Indonesian food, as I mentioned over and over again, is because there's no foundation to grow on. We know that we have good recipes, we know that we have a good dish, but a good product is not enough. You know, you need a good brand, you need a good marketing, you need a good strategy, you need a good foundation for people to actually learn and connect with. And without it, you only have a random product on the street, you know, and that's usually never get anywhere. And then a big part of the job for Indonesia, if they want to bring Indonesian cuisine to the forefront of worldwide, you know, they need to start building this foundation, start investing in it at least.
So what would you want them to do as the first few steps?
Well, create a standard, to be frank, right? So start with smaller stuff, right? Help Indonesian build a restaurant outside of Indonesia. And then on top of it, you know, make sure that they actually have certain dishes that they can highlight, right? And then on top of it, there's like education platform that they can understand. And then at the same time, help them create a brand about Indonesia within their restaurant, within their establishment, that can actually talk about the entire Indonesian cuisine as a whole. Yeah, because a small snippet of story is not enough, frankly.
So how do you do that in your business? Or are you not, are you doing something totally different?
We do a little bit of both, right? So Moonman has a funky brand to begin with, you know, but at the same time...
the logo is an astronaut.
We have a funky brand, but then at the same time, you know, we are educating people about Indonesian food all the time, mm-hmm. because, you know, we are telling them that this is Indonesian cuisine, and then we know that under description has Indonesia written everywhere. So we're not like hiding it, you know. And then at the same time, we introduce them about the common ingredients used in Indonesian cooking.
So if you wanted people to start, as they start learning about Indonesian cuisine, what are some of the dishes you want them to start recalling more immediately? You know, when people think of Filipino food, well, I don't know what they think of now, but when it first came out, it was like sisig. Like, what would you want those foods of Indonesia to be?
This is also the tricky thing about Indonesia a bit. The food are very regional. Like the food you find in Padang is a lot different than the food you find in Bali, for example. Like Bali has the babi guling, you know, which you cannot find anywhere else. And then Indonesia...
What is it?
Babi guling? Yeah. That's like a suckling pig. The horse pig. It's really delicious.
But in a mostly Muslim country is not...
But that's why they're popular in Bali, right? There's a reason why they stick in Bali.
Right.
So the food is very regional, and it doesn't mean that they can't create a food that can represent all of them, mm-hmm. right? So in the same way with Thai food, for example, there is like northern Thai food and southern Thai food that are completely different. But Thai food as a whole, there's a brand presence, right?
So the Thai government put a lot of money into that.
They have a lot of money put into it. There's a big campaign put into it. You know, there is guidelines for restaurants put into it. You know, so we need to start educating people, Indonesian people, how to actually start implementing this kind of system.
So there's a reason there's a Thai restaurant on every other street in New York City.
Of course. Yeah.
What are some of your iconic dishes when you think about your childhood or Indonesian food that you like to eat now? What are your favorites?
Well, it might be a little bit biased because I grew up in Surabaya, right? And Surabaya food is a lot different than, let's say, Jogja, for example. Jogja has good duck, right, which is very, very iconic. Good duck is this jackfruit stewed in sweet palm sugar.
Mm.
Yeah, a lot of food from Jogjakarta is kind of on the sweet side, usually, even though they're meant to be eaten with rice. And then Surabaya food is usually either salty or spicy. So we have a lot of those. And then next to us, the Madura food is famous for their fried duck. And
fried duck?
Oh, yeah. Their fried duck is very famous from Madura.
Is it fried whole?
No. Like chunks.
Oh, like fried chicken.
Yeah.
Huh?
But duck. Yeah.
So where would you direct somebody who wants to become more familiar with Indonesian food in New York City? Where would you send them? Other than the Queens Night Market and the Hello Moon and stuff.
there's a few restaurants in Queens that actually do a pretty good job. Yeah.
What? Such as?
Yeah.
Please tell us. Waiting. Don't keep
there
it.
There is I would go to Sky Cafe and get their lontong sayur is pretty good, and then their noodles are really good. Yeah. Nasi bungkus is pretty good too. And then there is this pop-up called Warung Selasa. It's every Tuesday the chef Devi make a random dish.
Oh.
And then just whatever she feels like, that's what you get.
I think one of our earlier guests, Lagaya Michan, wrote an article about it. But and there's also the is it monthly or quarterly an Indonesian food market?
Monthly, there is an Indonesian food bazaar. There is a few of them now, actually.
Oh, where?
Yeah, in Queens.
And there's one in the parking lot of a mosque in Elmhurst.
The one in Elmhurst is the one in the church and sometimes in the park. And then there is the parking lot in the mosque is in Astoria.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
You've been at both the Queens Night Market and now you've been in Bryant Park and you're going to open a brick and mortar store. Yeah. Can you tell us about the differences and similarities in operating in like very different neighborhoods of New York?
Well, the customers are different. Mm-hmm, that's what we found. Like, people go to Queens Night Market to eat, period. So
there's a lot of people.
they're going there to eat, right? And then what we found is that people at Queens Night Market is a lot more adventurous compared to people at Bryant Park. So people in Bryant Park is what we found is a little bit more reserved about trying new food, and it makes sense also because people go to Bryant Park not to eat. They go there to chill. And sometimes they would buy food, right? So it's a different mindset, I guess.
So what were some of the challenges in addressing that new market?
Well, the biggest challenge has always been the same, which is educational aspect of it. Like, we're essentially selling product that nobody knows. You know, we're the only one making coconut pancake. We're the only one making coconut pancake and Indonesian dessert. So we're really trying to educate people to understand that, hey, these are good stuff, you know. So the sampling has been helped, you know, like giving out tiny samples to people has helped a lot, actually.
What's been overall, would you say, the hardest part of starting and running Moon Man?
I would say that the education aspect for people to start learning about this Indonesian dessert.
It seems like you, as a designer, that you're perfectly suited to both serve delicious food and convey information. How have you done that?
Yeah, we have that advantage for sure. You know, because we redesign our product in a way that is a little bit more photogenic than what it is in Indonesia. So that helps
Some of the Instagram tweaks that you've made to make your product more photogenic?
No, we don't tweak the Instagram. We tweak the product.
No, that I know.
But what are the
product tweaks? Yeah. For example, right, our coconut pancake originally in Indonesia is a half moon shapes, and then there is multiples of them, and connected by really thin layers on top. And then what I found, because we want to brulee sugar tastes a lot better than just sprinkled sugar, right? So, if we brulee that same mold, that same pan, you know, the coconut pancake from that same pan, the whole thing gonna turn to ash. So there is no way we can use it. So we found this griddle that makes this hockey puck shape, you know, that actually sustain the heat from the blowtorch. So we changed that. And then the pandan steam cake in Indonesia is actually cooked inside of bamboo. And then the problem with that also is you know, you cannot control what comes out of it. the shape is always irregular, you know, and then you can get weird. You don't get the uniformity. You know?
Sure.
But at the same time, us as a vendor, you know, we want to make sure that every customer's experience is the same. So there's definitely no way we can use bamboo for that. So we tweak the mold for that. And then the cassava cake, the big cassava cake, what I found out is that people actually like the outside layer of the pinga because it has the caramelized sugar and then it's tastier, right? Mm-hmm. The one that has a little bit more browner. So what we did is that we make individual mold for the cassava. That way you get actually more of the burnt edges on the cassava cake. So yeah, we make a lot of this adjustment.
How did you get the customer feedback? Did you go out and ask people, or you're kind of waiting and people tell you? Did you send out surveys?
We try out with some close friends and then let them try our food and see what they think. And then we release it in the market and see what the people say.
And see which sells more.
Yeah.
What are some of the other ways that your background as a designer have influenced your work as a food entrepreneur?
Well, as I mentioned before, I approach Moon Man as a design project. So I don't approach it as opening up a business. It is a business, but I approach it as a design project. So I look at it like about fixing experiences, right? So we fix the product, you know, make it so that we can push it as far as we can so that the client can get the best of everything out of these humble creations. And then from the branding standpoint, our job is to actually make it stick, right? So it has to stand for a certain value, you know, and then people now know that everything come out from Moon Man is going to be, you know, this sweet Indonesian dessert that they don't commonly found anywhere. And then on the marketing side of it, we want to make sure that it actually stays fun and stays fresh all the time. So all of those elements of being a designer actually run in the DNA of Moon Man.
And then what about in the other direction? How has the experience of creating Moon Man changed the way that you work as a designer?
Well, it helps me get into the inside of, you know, if we get a food client in our studio, you know, suddenly like, oh, okay, so this is what you're dealing with.
I know what it feels like to make 800.
I've been there. Yeah. Yeah, it allows us to empathize more.
Well, awesome. We're going to take a short break and we will be back in just a few minutes. Please stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful, handcrafted agricultural journal. Each issue features stories about food history, seasonal recipes, artisanal products, and the amazing people who bring it to your table. Packed with stunning photography, the content is fresh and educational. Southern Farm and Garden takes you behind the scenes to meet farmers, gardeners, wineries, chefs, and artists who are passionate about creating healthy, unique, and sustainable food and products that you can enjoy all year. Are you interested in eating healthier and learning more about where your food comes from and living a more connected life? Purchase a copy today at southernfarmandgarden.com. Foodtank.com named Southern Farm and Garden one of the top 20 magazines for people who eat, cook, and grow, praising it for connecting readers with the food, the farms, and the stories behind our food system. Subscribe today or find a retailer near you at southernfarmandgarden.com.
And welcome back. We are talking to Nigel. Tell me how to say your last name one more time.
Siligar.
I butchered someone's name multiple times yesterday. I'm feeling very self-conscious. From Hello Moon Man, we were just talking a little bit about the concept that you have, the cakes that you make, and now you're going to be opening a brick and mortar shop. Yeah. So can you tell us about how that process came about after you opened up in Queens Night Market about a year or so ago? That's a pretty quick change. And how you're feeling going into moving into a space that's twice the size in a permanent location.
Well, it's about time in a way. Queenside Market for us, for me and Vinny, our booth, are just a proof of concept, right? So we're testing out the system, testing out the product. We're testing out the whole operation and see how it works. And then we're scaling up to a brick-and-mortar store because brick-and-mortar will allow us to do a lot more. You know, because to begin with, we don't need to break down and set up all the time.
Yes, so I can speak to that. That
helps a lot, right? So with the brick and mortar, that means we have more facility and support. That means we can actually expand the menu. We can do more offerings. We can experiment a little bit more. You know, so we kind of need a home for it.
And this is one of the questions we got on Instagram. When did you know that you were ready for the brick and mortar?
Oh, you never know. I mean, you have to. The way I see it is that we have to approach it with a business in mind, right? A bit business minded. So we have to assess the risks. We have to know the advantage. We have to know what our asset, and then from all of those, then we know whether it's the right move or not. You know, it's about risk management more than anything.
And can you tell us the brick and mortar you are going to be moving into? It's also in kind of a vendor situation, what the space will look like, what the menu will look like when you open.
So the new place is called the Market Line. It's going to open in Lower East Side. And then it's on Delancey and Essex. You know, it's going to be on the basement floor. And then we're next to the big grand hall that going to come into the space, basically. So we're in a good position in there, like in a good location. And then, the space is only about 160 square feet.
That's bigger than the space you have now.
Oh, of course. the current one, we have 100 square feet, right? 10 by 10, tenth. And then even then, we only use like 50% of it. Yeah, but with the new space, we can offer a lot more menu, like a lot more Indonesian dessert that you don't find at the market these days.
Can you tell us what some of those desserts are going to be? Is it top secret?
You don't want a surprise?
I want
to know in advance and then pretend to be surprised.
I want a surprise when I get there and actually taste it, but I... like what are you going to be making?
Well, I mean, let's think about this. You know, the concept of jajan pasar, right? The Indonesian dessert. There's a ton of it, like hundreds of them that we're exploring right now. But the way we decided on the menu is based on A, common ingredients, and B, common method of productions. Because again, if we add way too many ingredients, that means we have to add way too many infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You know, that means we have to buy a lot more different kind of equipment too. So we're slowly scaling it in that direction.
I think this is one of the things that a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with, especially in food, where there's this impulse to want to make everything, to want to show off a range of skills in the kitchen.
Share things that you like.
Yeah.
That's not only in food.
Maybe
that's,
not.
That's commonalities between a lot of my clients. You know?
So
we're
are there
trying
things
to do everything, but then what I keep telling them is that, well, it's better to have a small menu that does really, really well than a really big menu that does so-so, right?
Is there anything you've ever added to the menu that you take away or took away or things
well,
that
we,
you...
Well, we just replaced our cassava menu. Mm. We used to have a steamed cassava, and the steamed cassava is a snack that I like as a kid. Yeah, yeah, it's really good. It's really delicious, but at the same time, it's very labor-intensive. So what we found out is that after doing it for, introducing it for like a good 5 months, 5-6 months, you know, we'll see how we can tweak it and keep it running and all the same. But at the same time, we start hitting a brick wall because we realize that if we continue this, we won't be able to expand. Like, it's not a scalable menu. And then that's why we decided to replace that. Hence, we're bringing in the big cassava cake, you know, to replace that cassava.
You've also played around with some drink ideas too, right?
Yeah, we work with the suppliers to start bringing Indonesian coffee. So we have a cold brew Sulawesi coffee in our booth.
And how does that do, or how does that fit in with the bigger concept?
Well, coffee always works with dessert. So. And also, I'm a heavy, heavy, heavy coffee drinker. That's for sure. So might as well have it in our menu.
Can you tell us how Indonesian coffee tastes? Are there different how it tastes different from other?
We use 100% Sulawesi coffee. So our coffee has a lower acidity than most, mm-hmm. you know, and which just makes it the perfect bean for cold brew, to be honest. Because cold brew, the reason why people are doing cold brew to begin with is because they want to avoid the acidity, right, than the hot brew. So the cold...
I think the reason why people drink cold brew is because it's trendy. I don't think people know that well, much about the acidity, but fine, yes.
Don't from, say from that. The food point
standpoint, yes. From the food standpoint, it's about the acidity content. So the Sulawesi coffee actually makes the best cold brew because it has lower acidity from the bean.
Why does the... Is that just the inherent trend?
Okay. Yeah, it's just the product.
That's so interesting. For one of the things you mentioned over lunch is that because you guys sell desserts, a lot of the line hits you kind of later in the day.
Yeah.
But then you get like a rush. Yeah. And you mentioned early on this episode that, you know what, the first time it took an hour to make these coconut pancakes.
Yeah.
How were you able to streamline that process now that you've been in business for a while, making sure that customers are ordering and getting their food within a minute?
Yeah, we're able to get them within a minute because we were able to know how we can actually cut down on the prep time. Like between the coconut pancake being cooked versus the coconut pancake being brûlée all the way into the customer's hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then we streamlined the way we plate things, you know. So we plate a lot faster than we used to be because we used to be like scrambling all over the place. And then the addition of having a pandan steam cake and a baked cassava really helped too because those are prepared goods, right? So we don't have to cook them on site. We just need to finish them on site. So a lot of those cuts a lot of the serving time for sure.
One of the questions, follow-up questions on Instagram is scaling up. How do you prepare for scaling up? Going from 400, 800, and then presumably doubling that for your new brick and mortar.
Mm-hmm. Well, bigger often. What else do you
need? That's it?
Yeah, you just need bigger infrastructure, you know, which is not terrible. I mean, usually, if it works at a small scale, scaling up is a lot easier than scaling down. That's the part that people sometimes forget, you know, like a lot of people are buying like this giant machine, you know, to run, to make things. And then what we realize is that, well, if your capacity of sales doesn't go that high, why do you need this expensive piece of equipment, right? So you can always buy bigger machine, but you cannot replace the bigger machine to make a smaller stuff, you know, so that's the people don't realize it.
I'm really struck by how calm and analytical you are about this whole process. We, Jenny and I, are both food entrepreneurs ourselves in various ways. We know and have interviewed and have worked with many, many, many more. Yeah. I don't think I've ever met somebody who's so like matter of fact about it.
Yeah, we're not calm.
As you are.
That's the thing.
Yeah. People, food is inherently emotional. It's connected to childhood, memory, heritage, all kinds of other things.
It is.
And so it's sort of, I guess, notoriously difficult to be so analytical and detached about it.
Yeah.
Especially if you put something there that you're attached to and people don't like it. I'm like crying in the kitchen. You know what I mean?
I think that my design background and my entrepreneurship, you know, I've been running my own business for how long now? It's been quite a while, right?
Since 2010?
Design Factory is already like 8 years old this year. So yeah, I think that kind of helped, you know. So being a good entrepreneur means that you have to know what you're good at when you're not, and then you have to know where to wear different hats. So you can't be the chef all the time in the kitchen, and you can't be the person who's emotional all the time, but you also have to be the business person. You have to be the operation person, and then each one of them has to be detached.
And most people have trouble changing hats, right?
Yeah.
Most people, either because you're good at you're better at one thing. I mean, this is definitely the case for me. I'm better at certain things and definitely not good at other things, but that are all of those things are necessary for running my business. And some of them I'm good at and some of them I'm just not. And I've either had to live with that or work around them or get help from other people who are better at the things that I'm not good at. How are you, I guess what I'm asking is, how are you so good at changing hats? Is it, I guess you've also, through your design work, supported a lot of other entrepreneurs through their process. Has that, what lessons have you learned from them? Or is that, does that have to do with your ability now to transition between roles so smoothly?
Well, to begin with, my parents run a small business in Indonesia. Back then when I was a kid, you know, we have like a really, really tiny store. And then the second floor was our home. And then...
what kind of business?
We sell rice. Yeah, my parents sell rice.
Cooked or raw?
Raw.
Okay.
Raw, yeah. And then they become the wholesaler, and then they need a bigger space, and then they become, it's a growing, you know, I've seen them build everything from nothing, basically. So I learned a lot about business from them. So I didn't go to business school, right? And this is also the bigger issue about running movement, because I don't have culinary background either. So it's a little bit harder on that end. But thankfully we have Wenny, right? So Wenny cooks a lot more than I do, for sure. And then she knows more her way around the kitchen than I do, you know. So a lot of this stuff she can handle, that side of it, you know, like dealing with suppliers, getting ingredients and this kind of stuff. And me dealing more with the business development and branding and promotions and, you know, signing up for markets, dealing with paperwork. Yeah, so we have both ends of it, you know. So what I'm not good at, she can cover it. You know, what she's not good at, I can cover it. So yeah.
With the upcoming brick and mortar, will you guys be expanding your team?
Oh yeah, we have to. Yeah, we have to. There is no way. I mean, it runs 7 days a week now, and I'm not going to abandon my course design factory for sure.
How do you know who to hire? How do you make sure that the next, you know, generation of workers that you are bringing on embody that same, like, the ethos of Moonman and also just love it the way you do?
That's the tricky thing. I mean, that's the hardest thing about running a business, and this is not only food business, it's any business, it's finding people. Finding people is the hardest thing. And then the problem with design firms to begin with is that you're under specialty service business. So that means your business is meant to not grow. Because if a design firm grow, what happens is that, well, you know, client hire a course design factory because I'm in it. If I'm not in it, mm-hmm. they're not going to be, you know, hiring the firm. And then with the Moonman, it's slightly different because whether I'm in the booth or not, people are still going to buy the coconut pancake. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have that advantage to be able to detach myself from the system, right? And then what I realized also is that with the Moonman, we can actually break down a lot of the processes into smaller chunks. And then with smaller chunks, that means we can start the assembly line, right? So different people doing smaller, different tasks. And that's a lot easier to train, because if you're training a designer, it can take years. You know? And then if they left, they left. But if you're training people for smaller chunks of tasks, if they left, it's easier to replace. You know? That's the difference.
What advice would you give to other aspiring entrepreneurs, either in food or other areas, from your own experience and from your experience helping with designs for other new companies?
On what end?
Somebody who's thinking about starting a food business, what do you think they need to know?
There's a lot of things to know about running a business.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the most important part is that you have to know what you're selling and how to sell it, right? So number one is that we talk about branding a little bit, right? So when you're dealing with a lot of people saying that, you know, I want to have a brand of a product, whatever that is, whether it's food, whether it's a restaurant, whatever that is. So when you're talking about branding, you're talking about two things, the differentiation and then the value creation of it. The differentiation meaning that you have to have an edge that makes you different enough that you're not comparable with everyone. The point that you're comparable, just enough bits of similarities, people start comparing prices, and prices are the worst war. You just don't want to get in it. And then the second thing is that you want to create a value creation. So that means you have to be able to create something that the customer value on top of just your product in whatever shape or size or form that is.
For Moonman, what is that?
Well, I mean, Moonman, we know that we have good quality products, right? And then we're the only one who's providing this experience of Indonesian dessert currently that is a little bit more refined and modernized than most.
And how do you suggest other people figure those questions out? Either how did you figure them out or what? How should other people do that?
To large mojito will help. But yeah, it's not easy, you know, because partially I think the prerequisite to be an entrepreneur is that you have to be creative. If you're not creative, then that's the end of it. You know, knowing how to do something well is not enough, because you have to figure out how to maintain the system and then how to evolve it over time. You know, yeah.
How do you anticipate Moonman changing over time in the future?
I would not anticipate it. I would adapt it.
Good answer.
Well, of course, like we don't know what the future holds, you know. But at the same time, if we know that we're malleable and adaptable at all times, then of course we can survive.
All right. In the last few minutes of the show, we're gonna do a more personal, fun, lighthearted. Mm-hmm. We always say it's gonna be rapid fire, and then it 100% never is.
No,
rapid
we just
fire.
Are like wandering around.
We just like to answer the questions in long ways. That went anyway. Yeah. So how do you want to start?
What did you eat for lunch as a kid?
Oh yeah, we already know a little bit about what you ate after school.
Tell us more.
But what was lunch like as a kid in Indonesia?
Well, mm-hmm. we a lot of street food, to be honest. I mean, I grew up in a family where my parents doesn't cook.
Not even rice?
What?
Not even rice?
Well, they know how to cook rice, but then they don't know how to cook everything else. You know, like rendang or whatever, right? So I. In a way, it's like I'm lucky and not at the same time. I'm not lucky because I don't have a proper home-cooked food that, you know, that recipe that passed down from generations and stuff like that. We don't have any of it. But it's a good thing because suddenly my parents go out and buy food all the time, you know, and whether it's from a small vendors or a big restaurant and vice versa. So me and my siblings are very, very, very spoiled. You know, we have the entire Surabaya as our chefs.
You were allowed to eat on the street as when you're in school? Like, did you have like a break during lunch?
Yeah, we have a break during lunch. And
you
then
could
we
go out to street vendors?
Yeah.
I'm
like, wait,
well,
what is
this? I mean, technically, like we're not allowed to go out to street vendors.
Nigelis
but then
is
we
doing
just,
air
we
quotes
just,
as he tells us this.
We just pass the food through the fence somehow.
What?
Yeah.
An underground lunch market.
It's an underground situation.
So what was your favorite lunch dish or favorite vendor to get lunch from?
Oh, man. I eat a lot of bakso. I need a lot of fried rice. You know. I mean, I went to a Catholic school, right? And then if they go to church, I go to the street vendors who sell fried rice.
What?
Yeah, I somehow just sneak out and have lunch instead.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Superpower? How to teleport, I would think.
Oh, yeah.
That
me
will
too.
Save a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Are there other reasons to teleport, or is it just a purely practical?
Practical. You know, I can go back home to Indonesia when I feel like it. I can see my parents when I feel like it. I can, yeah.
And what about a skill? If you could master a skill overnight, what would it be?
A skill overnight? I would think, I don't know. I would love to be smarter.
What does that mean?
Join the club.
I know, right? I would love to be smarter.
To be smarter.
So
well, smarter at what?
At, I don't know, computation maybe? Like, yeah.
Being able to tell people how much they owe you without a calculator? Well, you must be able to do that already.
Yeah, being able to be to figure out data without really
what
crunching.
How would you apply that skill? What would you what data would you analyze?
I have no idea. Maybe that will help in, you know, Moonman.
If your friends could describe you as an animal, what would that animal be?
I never asked that. I mean, I got baby panther before.
Panther.
I got a hedgehog before.
Are you prickly?
And I don't know.
A hedgehog. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
How would you define success? Or what's definition of success applied to you and to your
life? Oh, there's no
to your life.
Tell us more about that. What does that mean?
Well, success is just like perfections, right? So it's a term that turn around, but at the same time is something that other people have to apply to your situation more than actually you apply to yourself. There is no limit to where you can push things. So yeah, why put a fence on it?
But how is there a point where you feel successful? Like when you're thinking about what you're doing?
No, probably never.
Such an entrepreneur's answer.
Yeah.
Never successful.
Probably never. I would just, there is always things to improve, right? So I don't think there is an end to it. So it's more like a way of living. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe I being interviewed that. On the Why Food podcast could be a
definition,
at least a stepping stone towards success.
Well, Nigel, thank you so much for being on the show today. Can you tell our listeners where to find you, where to find Moon Man, and where to find Moon Man soon when you guys open?
Sure. We're usually at the Queenstown Market. However, we have
every Saturday night.
Every Saturday evening. And then we always announce our schedule on our website.
Which is?
HelloMoonMan.com. And then our Instagram, we also post it every week about where we are, where our schedule is. If you see the ticking timer, that's our announcement. And then, the brick and mortar is going to be at the Market Line, but that's going to open early next year.
And what's your Instagram handle?
Personal?
Either personal, if you want to share that, or, sure. or I was talking about your Moon Man one.
Moon Man Instagram handle is Hello Moon Man. The personal one is Nigel C, Nigel S-I-E.
And if people are interested in an amazing tour of the fantastic restaurants of Queens, I would suggest
I eat everywhere.
Nigel eats out a lot. All right, not just in Queens, and eats out a lot, and always seems to post beautiful pictures of amazing things that you're eating. And I'm always jealous that I'm not eating with you.
Well, it's because I don't have a lot of time in my hand, so I don't have time to cook, so I have to eat out all the time. Yeah. So that's
tough life.
Come naturally.
Can you also told us you were in a Vice episode? Is that right?
Yes.
Can you tell our listeners where to find that?
I'm not sure if it's still online, but I was in the Untitled Action Bronson show before it got discontinued. But I was with Ice-T and then
Action Bronson.
And Action Bronson. And Ice-T was brewing my coconut pancakes, so it was fun.
Was he good?
What?
Was he good at brûlée? He
did a pretty good job, even though he never brûlée anything in his entire life before. And he hates coconut, too, but he liked my pancakes, so figure that.
And there was absolutely no marijuana involved in the shooting of the episode, I'm sure.
Well, let's say that even if you don't smoke, you get high.
Nigel, it's been such a pleasure having you join us for this last episode of our summer season. We will be back the first week of September. With a whole new lineup of awesome guests. And in the meantime, obviously feel free to reach out whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org or on our Instagram.
At whyfoodpodcast.
And you can follow me and my spice adventures at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram, burlapandbarrel.com.
And I'm over at Chef Jenny Dorsey. And thank you again to David for sound engineering all our episodes this summer season. And to the Blind by the Red Crickets is our theme song. Every week I switch it up. You know, yeah. I'm not sure if it's Blind or it's Red Crickets. Thank you for joining us this season. And we are super excited to be back in a few weeks.
See you soon.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization, driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Well, that's history, oh my. All the time. I don't know.